We'd like to start the program today by talking about part-time jobs and how they are working or are not working for millions of Americans. Now, for years, part-time work has been touted as a way for young people to get income while going to school, or for seniors to supplement their retirements, or for working parents to handle family responsibilities. More recently, though, millions of workers are working part-time because full-time work is not available. The part-time workforce is bigger than ever, some 27.4 million Americans, and since 2007, the number of part-timers who say they'd rather have full-time work has doubled to 7.5 million. And now there is a new focus on the burdens of part-time work, as workers say unpredictable schedules are creating more economic and personal hardships for workers who cannot plan childcare, class schedules, or even budget how much money they'll have at the end of a week. Now some members of Congress are taking notice. They want to change that with the Schedules That Work Act. It's legislation that would require service sector employers to provide steady schedules to their employees. We wanted to talk more about all of this, so we've called Stephen Greenhouse. He is labor and workplace reporter for the New York Times, and he's been writing about this recently. Also with us is NPR senior business editor Marilyn Giewax, here with us once again in our Washington, D.C. studios. Welcome to you both. Thank you for coming.
Hi.
Nice to be here.
So, Stephen Greenhouse, you report on workplace issues, and you recently wrote a story on this topic, and you got so many responses that you had to do a follow-up story only a couple of days later. Can you just give us an idea of what kinds of challenges workers are facing and tell us maybe one story that really stood out for you?
So last Wednesday I had a front page story about the unpredictable, erratic, herky-jerky scheduling that makes life very difficult for a lot of workers, especially female workers. And I wrote about this woman, Mary Coleman, 60-year-old woman in Milwaukee, who has a job at Popeyes. So she commutes an hour each way to her Popeyes restaurant. And Mary told me that about 2 weeks ago, she showed up one afternoon after her hour-long bus ride, and her boss said, "Sorry, we don't need you today. Go home. Don't even clock in. We have enough workers already." And this was even though Mary was scheduled to work that day. So Mary just headed back home. She didn't get paid a cent that day. And, you know, there were over 440 readers who wrote in response to my story, and one of them, in the second most highly recommended comment on the New York Times website, said, "You know, this should be criminal. You know, she paid for the bus. She spent 2 hours of her time going back and forth, and she wasn't paid a cent." And this reader wrote that this seems Dickensian, right out of the 19th century.
Well, not only that, one of the other things you reported on was the fact that when workers said, like you wrote about, like, for example, one comment was from a teacher who had been laid off from a job and was shocked to find out that when he told people, "Look, I need to go back to school as well," that they either cut his hours or in one instance walked him out of the interview and said, "You have to leave now, because if you're not willing to be available for this entire period of time, say 6 days a week, all day long, when we call you, we won't even talk to you." Or workers who did ask for more regular schedules or sometimes had their hours cut. How common was that?
It's quite common, Michelle. I think there's several forces at work that have made work schedules much more erratic, herky-jerky, unpredictable. One is, the unemployment rate has been fairly high. Workers are much more insecure, and I think employers therefore feel they can kind of push their workers more, you know, jerk them around on schedules. There's this phenomenon now called on-call work. And I interviewed this retail employee in New York City who said she was scheduled for one regular shift in a week and four on-call shifts, meaning every morning she had to call in first thing in the morning to see whether they needed her at the store that day. So she wasn't able to make plans that day, wasn't able to, schedule lunches with friends or whatever. And there's this rise in on-call scheduling. A second factor is there's been this development of the sophisticated scheduling software that many retailers and restaurants use that kind of keeps hour-to-hour computation of how many workers you need at any moment. So, you know, there are, you know, restaurants, you know, fast food restaurants that say, "Well, we need, you know, eight workers for the morning, for the breakfast shift. Then, you know, we want our workers to clock out from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. Then we want them to clock back in for the lunch shift." And workers feel really jerked around. They feel it's unfair that they have to clock out those 2 hours and sometimes have to stay around the restaurant. And so this teacher I wrote about, you know, who was laid off after 20 years teaching because the school district didn't have enough money. So he, you know, he needed money to support his family. So, you know, he's a guy who's used to being, you know, he has a master's degree, he's used to be treated with respect. He applies for some retail jobs, and they say, "We're not going to hire you for more than 29 hours a week, and you have to be scheduled, as you said, Michelle, 24/7. And he said, "Well, you know, can you just schedule me like from 9 to 2 for this job so I could, you know, look for a second job? And they said, if you're not going to be available 24/7, forget it. This interview's over. Get out of here. I mean, it's pretty shocking.
Marilyn G. Wex, you know, as we mentioned, a number of employers have traditionally touted the flexible schedule as a way to kind of live your life and accomplish other goals as well. Has something changed? I mean, Steve Greenhouse started talking about this. What's changed in recent years that are leading to these kinds of complaints? Or are people just more willing to voice complaints?
Well, I think one of the big things that's changed is probably in your pocket. It's the mobile phone. You know, when I was working in retail in college, if I had a schedule and it was set, I knew that's when I was supposed to be there. If my boss wanted to change it, she had to call my house, make the phone ring, and I had to answer it. And you didn't have the expectation that workers would absolutely answer the phone and know to come out. Now a lot of employers expect you to have a mobile device of some sort so that they can text you, instant message you. They want you to be on call, literally, all the time. So the ability to reach your workers for last-minute scheduling changes has really had an impact. Also, our social norms have changed. Again, you know, when I was younger, if I wanted to see the latest adventures of the Huxtables, I would have to be home on Thursday night at 8 o'clock because that's when the networks were going to show it. But you know, now everything is on demand. I watch TV when I feel like it because I can time shift. Well, everyone has sort of gotten used to this idea that things are very flexible, that it's all on demand. So there's kind of a social change in the way employers see workers. They now view them more as inventory than human beings. You know, you're supposed to be on the shelf, ready to be used when needed, and all I have to do is text you and you'll show up. So it's a different way of looking at workers.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about the impact of unpredictable schedules on part-time workers and growing complaints about that. Our guests are NPR's Marilyn G. Wex and Stephen Greenhouse of the New York Times, who recently wrote about this. So Stephen Greenhouse, one of the points that a lot of people made, though, is that how do you plan childcare around something like that? Because kids aren't human spackle. You can't just, like, you know, put them on the shelf and take them off the shelf. So I see that members of Congress are taking note of this. What are they suggesting? And what has been the response to that?
So there was a news conference yesterday on Capitol Hill where George Miller, the senior Democrat on the House Education and Labor Committee, Rosa DeLauro, you know, another senior Democrat from Connecticut, Elizabeth Warren, and Tom Harkin, and Democrats in the Senate, they're pushing a bill that would, that calls for 2 weeks advance notice for your work schedule, that if your work schedule is changed 24 hours before you have to go to work, they have to pay you an extra hour that day. I told a story about this woman, Mary Coleman in Milwaukee, who showed up for work. They said, sorry, we don't need you now. Go home. Under these proposals, you'd have to pay someone at least a minimum of four hours just for showing up for work on a scheduled day. Even if you send them home after 3 hours, you still have to pay them 4 hours because you want to. The idea is if workers, you know, schedule their day so they have, you know, to show up at work, you know, and they do so, you got to pay them for at least 4 hours that day. I think Marilyn made a good point before. I wanted to add one other thing. This, you know, terrific professor I interviewed at University of Chicago, who's really the nation's foremost expert on scheduling, Susan Lambert, said, remember, employers, you know, store managers, restaurant managers are under huge pressure to hold down costs. They don't have a lot of power to hold down wages, to hold down benefits, but one way they could easily reduce, you know, what they spend on labor is cutting employee hours. And I think that's another reason that we're seeing a lot of employers telling people like Mary Coleman or other workers, well, you know, we don't need you. You can go home after 3 hours. Business has slowed down. And Marilyn was absolutely right. That's made much, much easier now because people have mobile phones and your employer can text you and say, you know, maybe we don't need you to come in today because it's raining or business is slow.
Marilyn, one of the other people who commented on Stephen's piece, obviously, were employers whose attitude was, you should be glad you have a job, or who do you think you are to be making these kinds of demands, that this is the way the market works and you just have to adapt to the current environment. So you have to assume that that point of view is kind of present as well. Here in Washington, you talk to members of Congress all the time. Is there any, we've mentioned that there's some growing interest in this, but does that interest have traction? Or, you know, what's the growing sentiment here? We have about a minute and a half left.
It's complicated because there are some things that are very popular with voters. For example, raising the minimum wage is actually extremely popular. There's almost unanimity. Polls are anywhere from 80 to 90% of Americans think that $7.25 an hour is too low. So it's not hard to get people on board with this in terms of the voters, but actually getting something through Congress at this time is very difficult because Congress is quite divided. The idea that this kind of legislation would get through, especially the Republican-controlled House, seems very unlikely right now. But, you know, it is something that, at the very least, it's now a topic of conversation in a way that we were not hearing 4 or 5 years ago. At the worst of the recession, actually, there was a sentiment that any work is better than no work. But the further we get into this more technologically sophisticated workplace, the more these work flexible schedules are happening, there's almost a rebellion among people. A lot of workers are very frustrated about this, and it's becoming a political issue, especially a lot of women are affected by this. But in terms of specific legislation passing Congress, I think that's quite unlikely, at least for the foreseeable future.
Marilyn G. Wax is NPR senior business editor. Stephen Greenhouse is labor and workplace reporter for The New York Times. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Now it's time for our Wisdom Watch. That's the part of the program where we speak with those who've made a difference through their work. Today we want to take a look at two groundbreaking museums that are celebrating important milestones this year, and we will speak with the people who lead them. The National Museum of African Art marks its 50th anniversary this year. Now part of the Smithsonian Institution, it contains more than 10,000 African art objects, the largest publicly held collection of both traditional and contemporary African art in the United States. Jeanette B. Cole is director of the Smithsonian National Museum of African Art, and she is with us now once again in our Washington, D.C. studios. Welcome back to the program. Thank you for coming.
It's good to be here.
Another Smithsonian institution celebrating a milestone anniversary this year is the National Museum of the American Indian. 25 years ago this November, Congress passed the National Museum of the American Indian Act, establishing it as part of the Smithsonian. Since then, it has dedicated itself to sharing the culture, languages, history, and arts of Native American people. Kevin Gover is director of the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of the American Indian, and he's also here with us once again in our Washington, D.C. studios. Welcome to you as well. Happy anniversary to you both.
Thank you very much.
Now, I thought it would be fun to get the two of you together for a number of reasons. These are significant anniversaries, but also because neither of you is a lifelong museum person. Each of you had kind of a different route to this position. So, Kevin Gover, I'll start with you. You're a member of the Pawnee Tribe of Oklahoma. Your parents were Indian activists. You had a long career in law before you came to Washington the first time as Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs. So I was wondering what led you to this job.
I never imagined that I would end up running a museum, let alone a Smithsonian museum. But when the opportunity arose, it was too attractive not to at least consider and then finally decide that, yes, this is something I'd really like to do. What attracted me to it is simply the opportunity to change people's understandings of Native history and culture, because there are so many misunderstandings. The Smithsonian is such a huge platform that it was too good an offer to refuse.
Dr. Cole, what about you? Many people know you've had a very distinguished career as an educator, but many people know you as the leader of not one, but two different historically Black institutions, very well known. What led you to want to do this position at a time when, you know, a lot of people would have been very understanding if all you wanted to do is sit on your porch and drink iced tea?
Well, I could rephrase your question to say, why in the world would I get a third F-minus in retirement? And the answer is very similar to the one that my brother Kevin has given. How could I not, once it was explained as to what I was to do, how could I not take advantage of this opportunity? In many ways, to do in a museum setting what I've always done and loved, and that is to engage in that amazing human enterprise called teaching and learning. And just as Kevin and our colleagues at that museum want to help folk to rethink how they think about Native American people, we simply want to help folk rethink how they think about Africa.
Well, you know, that was actually leading to another question I had, which is that, Kevin Gover, I'll start with you on this one, which is the rap on museums is that they're boring. And
yeah,
I just wonder, or that they're for people who are used to absorbing information in a certain way, which is like a two-dimensional way. There's stuff that you look at, and then you read about it, and then that's what you do. And so what are you doing about that?
Well, nobody wants to read a lecture on the wall. And we laugh at our museum because we're always handing out these stern lectures to people about, you know, you really shouldn't believe certain things that you've been taught. And we don't want to do that so much. We want them to have fun and learn and then ask themselves, I wonder why I didn't know that before. And I wonder what else I don't know.
Can you talk a little bit more about that? Have you engaged in some self-correction over the course? You haven't been with the museum the entire time. It's been there over the 25 years. You're far too young. But has the life of the museum engaged in some self-correction from this kind of a finger-pointing, guilt-inducing, you're wrong, admit it, and I'll applaud kind of point of view? Have you felt that to be necessary to do?
The museum was never really accusatory, but we do. We spend a lot of time. I mean, it is a museum, so we muse a great deal. And in our case, we mused about, so what do people take away from our museum? Is that what we want them to take away? And if not, what do we do to change it? And what are the stories that we need to tell in order to get them to hear the key messages that we're trying to deliver?
What about you, Dr. Hall? How do you, you've spent your so much of your life working with younger people, connecting to young people, educating them, and is there something that's changed for you over the course of time and how you want to think about having those conversations and bringing people?
Well, I think for many young people, their world is actually more complex, and I'm almost going to say more interesting than the world that I grew up in. You know, I grew up in the southern part of the United States of America in those horrific days of legalized racial discrimination. And so during those days, so much of one's life was against those obscene narratives. At least we now live in a country where those narratives are no longer to be articulated and acted upon in public. And so for young folk who are coming into a museum of African art, I think it is with a different set of experiences. And we want to relate to those experiences. But because we know the importance of history and her story, we also want it to be a museum where they understand about apartheid, where they understand about the enslavement of African peoples. And so it's a bit of a dance to speak to their new way of thinking and dreaming, and yet to have them, our young'uns, as I affectionately call these folk, to have our young'uns always place themselves in some kind of a historical context. You know, the way we sometimes say it with an African proverb is, looking back in order to go forward. Or where I grew up, we say, look, you can't know where you're going if you don't know where you have been.
There are some who might wonder, why is the National Museum of African Art on the National Mall, which a lot of people associate with kind of telling the American story?
Because quite simply, Africa belongs everywhere. After all, it is the only place on earth where each and every one of us can say accurately, we have come from there. We are all, in that sense, Africa's people. But secondly, I would say that while the Smithsonian is so deeply associated with American people, with America's complex stories, our stories are never fully understood until we put them in much larger contexts, including the context of the world.
Kevin Gover, what about you? What story do you want people to take away from your institution?
Well, that the Americas at the time of contact and for millennia before that were thriving. They were self-sufficient, that civilizations rose and fell just as they had in the rest of the world. And that when contact occurred, it changed the world because of the accomplishments that Native people had achieved while they were alone in the Americas. It's much like Janetta said, you can't understand America without understanding the world. By the same token, you can't understand the world without understanding America and Native Americans in particular, and what happened because of the Native civilizations that pre-existed contact.
It's interesting. You use the word contact. I think a lot of people are used to hearing the word discovered. Why do you think it's important to use that word?
Well, because obviously Columbus didn't discover anything. The people were already here. And it's more accurate to say that this moment, this moment of contact between the Americas and the rest of the world really was the most important moment in known human history in defining the world that we live in today. That was the great moment of globalization, not the passage of NAFTA or any of that. It was when these two completely independent groups of people realized each other and began to take advantage of the accomplishments that each brought to the table.
If you're just joining us, we are having a Wisdom Watch conversation. That's where we hear from people who make a difference through their work, or have made a difference, are making a difference. We're speaking with Kevin Gover. He's director of the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of the American Indian, and Janetta B. Cole, director of the Smithsonian National Museum of African Art. Both are observing significant anniversaries this year, so we thought it would be fun to get the two of them together. Kevin Gover, do people ever have trouble, guests at the museum ever have trouble with that shift in consciousness from the idea of this group of people discovering this land or this other group of people to these two different groups encountering each other?
Are they ever annoyed?
Well,
quite often our staff receives complaints from some visitors. One of the things you hear a lot is we're being politically correct, that we're really sort of changing the narrative, to which we plead guilty. We are attempting to change the common narrative because it's wrong. And we believe using words like contact or encounter are much more accurate than saying Columbus discovered America.
Dr. Cole, is there any narrative you feel you're trying to correct in some way, or any misunderstanding you're trying to correct with your work?
The real American story does have far more going for it and about it than these stereotypical notions. We can't totally change all of those narratives, but we certainly can engage our visitors in conversations. We can simply, through the placement of art objects, through our educational programs, through our outreach, we can invite, again, conversations. We can pose questions. We can do, as Kevin has just said, use a different word with the ultimate goal of helping each of us to understand clearly the differences among us, but no less to understand the fundamental human similarities that make up the human race.
To that end, I noted that the museum had an exhibition on the cosmos, or scientific discovery as lived by African people.
Mm-hmm. It was a tremendous exhibition done by our deputy director and chief curator, Christine Mullen Kramer, an exhibition on cultural astronomy of Africa. Who in the world associates Africa with scientific discovery? Who associates Native American peoples with an incredible history and prehistory of involvement with scientific thought? And so for those of us who are directors, I hope no less than for the visitors who come, it's an incredibly exciting place to be, called a museum. And obviously these days we're facing challenges. Think about these young folk who walk into the museums. They don't look like typical museum goers. First of all, they barely walk in, or rarely, I should say, empty-handed. They've got these extensions to their hands, and they are engaged in a rapid amount of information giving and receiving. How do we, in our museums, not interrupt that, but use that kind of engagement in a way, again, to continue to engage in conversations, to pose the kind of questions that ask our visitors to rethink how they have been thinking.
Well, but before we let you, each of you go, would you just give us a word of wisdom? I mean, it can be about whatever, either wisdom that you've gained or gleaned from doing this work, or that wisdom you would hope that museum goers would take into the future, or what you hope for each of your institutions.
I think that the, I don't know if it's wisdom, but one thing that I've learned is that the more I learn, the less I know. And as I've really dug into my own study of Native history, I find that I cannot understand that unless I understand the history of other peoples. And as that becomes more clear, the story becomes more complex and tangled and messy, and it becomes more wonderful. And that's what we need to try to achieve at the Smithsonian, is to tell these wonderful stories in all of their complexity and messiness, and help people to become comfortable with that. And as Dr. Cole was saying, it's all about being human. And all of these different peoples were so very human, for good and ill. And it's okay. And we should learn about them so that we can avoid those kinds of mistakes in the future and repeat the great successes of the past.
Dr. Cole, final thought from you.
Well, when I think about the next 50 years at our museum, again, I want to lift up Warren Robins' notion that African art can help us to engage in cross-cultural communication. But I'm also thinking that in the next 50 years at our museum, how exciting it's going to be in partnership with the other museums at the Smithsonian, with museums around the world. I value collaboration. My colleagues and I do. And if in the next 50 years our museum can reach out and even more effectively relate to the Museum of the American Indian, to what is now called the Latino Center, the Asian and Pacific Islander Center, if these centers can then find ways to more effectively collaborate with the American History Museum, the American Art Museum. And so over the next 50 years or more, I really believe that partnerships and collaborations will help us to do our work better. One more proverb, an African proverb that says, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together.
Janetta B. Cole is director of the Smithsonian National Museum of African Art. Kevin Gover is director of the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of the American Indian. They were both here together in our Washington, D.C. studios. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you, Michelle.
Thank you, Michelle.
We're going to end the program today with music. In a few minutes, we'll offer an encore of our performance chat with the a cappella group Traces of Blue. But first, a musical word from me. As we've mentioned, our last broadcast is August 1st, and as we wind down production of the program, members of our staff have been sharing their favorite songs as part of our regular feature, In Your Ear. Today, it's my turn, so can I just tell you, this is what's on my playlist.
Okay, it's all right with me. Some things are just meant to be. It never comes easily. And when it does, I'm already gone.
It occurred to me that most of my music education really started when I came to NPR. And the people who've been most influential in kind of shaping my taste have been our directors. The first director of this program was Rob Sachs, and he introduced me to Eric Hutchinson. Okay is all right with me.
Okay is all right with me. Some people are scared to see what's happening frequently, but I would never shy from a fight.
You know, it's one of those things that when you hear it, you think, yeah, it's going to be all right. And one of the reasons I always liked Eric, I loved the interview I had with him because he had been through a time. I mean, his first record deal evaporated and, you know, all this drama. And at the point at which we met him, things were finally on the upswing. And I just, you know, loved how this song makes you think, you know what, it's going to be all right.
Hey, Macklemore, can we go thrift shopping?
What? Monica Evstatieva was our second director. She took over after Rob Sachs went on to other things. Monica really also has an ear for people who are up and coming.
I'm gonna pop some tags. Only got $20 in my pocket. I'm looking for a come up. This is being awesome.
She brought Macklemore to the program, and I'm still bitter that I was not here. I was actually on vacation the day that Macklemore and Ryan Lewis came in, but I still claim it. And of course, thrift shop, you know, who doesn't like that?
I wear your granddad's clothes. I look incredible. I'm in this big air coat from that thrift shop down the road. I wear your granddad's clothes. I look incredible.
Now come on, man.
I'm in this big air coat from that thrift shop down the road.
I've been waiting on, and my soul's overflowing.
Arjun Hutchins has been our director most recently, and he introduced me to K-John. K-John was a Detroit native, and his song, On the Ocean, I just really think speaks to a lot of what people have been going through over the last couple of years.
Sometimes it feels like everything is passing me by. Every now and then it feels alive. My ship has gone and sailed away.
I think the opening verse says it all. Sometimes it feels like everything is passing me by. I think a lot of people feel that way, and I just think K-John really captured something very truthful about the way a lot of people have lived these last couple of years. I mean, a lot of people have struggled, and I think the song is very wistful, and at times it's painful, but it's also very hopeful, too, and I love it.
On this moment, my ship is finally gone.
Let's move.
And the final influence on my musical taste is, of course, my children. Those of you who say the kids don't control the dial when they're in the car with you, well, I don't believe you. But one thing that my kids and I can agree on is Beyoncé. And one song we all like is Move Your Body.
I'm worried with me tonight. A little sweat ain't never hurt nobody.
So that's what's playing in my ear. So you just heard some of the music that I love and that I learned about on this program. And if you've been with us for some or all of the last 7 years that we've been on the air, then you know that we've welcomed musical artists from all different backgrounds and genres to come in and perform and talk about their music. And that includes the a cappella group Traces of Blue. We first noticed them in 2011 when they were performing as Afro Blue on the NBC reality competition, The Sing-Off.
Drumming my pain with his finger.
Their performance of Killing Me Softly wowed the judges and the audience. Now, the group then was made up of classmates from Howard University's jazz program. Since then, they've left the nest, changed their name, and are taking the world of a cappella jazz by storm. Last summer, Traces of Blue joined us in our studios in Washington, D.C. to talk a little bit and sing a lot. We thought it would be a great time to revisit that conversation, and they started with a song that sums up what made them fan favorites on the sing-off, Estelle's American Boy.
One, two, three, and...
Take me on a trip, I'd like to go someday. Take me to New York, I'd love to see L.A. I'd really love to come and kick it with you. You'll be my American boy. Can we get away this weekend? Take me to Broadway. Let's go shopping, baby, then we'll go to a cafe. Let's go on the subway, take me to your hood. I've never been to Brooklyn, I'm going to see what's good. Dressed in all your fancy clothes, sneakers looking fresh to death, I'm loving those shell toes. Walking that walk, talking that slick talk, you'll be my American boy. Boy, 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 American boy.
What's your persona about that America? Drama and my shallow, cause all my clothes are designer.
I really want to come kick it with you. You'll be my American boy. American boy. Take me on a trip, I'd like to go. Take me to New York, I'd love to see L.A. I really want to come kick it with you. You'll be my American boy, American boy.
All right, that was American Boy, sung by Traces of Blue. And let me just confirm for people who aren't here, everything is happening right here. It's all contained within, no instruments, just the voices that you heard. And so why don't we ask you all to introduce yourselves.
Hi, my name is Devin Robinson.
Hi, I'm Integrity Reeves.
Hi, I'm Christy Dashiell.
Hi, I'm Reginald Bowens.
Hi, I'm Danielle Withers.
John Kennebrew.
And Eliza Burkhan.
And Reginald, I understand you are the music director, so I'll direct the question to you. This isn't everybody. This is not the whole group. How many all together?
There are 10 total.
10 total. How did you all get together?
Well, we started off as a class at Howard under the name Afro Blue, and in 2011, we went on to NBC's a cappella show, The Sing-Off, and after the show, we decided we're going to keep going. We changed our name, became a separate entity, and started performing more.
And how did The Sing-Off happen?
We were actually recommended by Cedric Dent, who used to be in Take Six, and you know, we got a call from the producers of the show. And
how had he heard you? Do you know?
Afro Blue actually performed with Take Six at one point. Yeah, and so he called. I guess, I don't know. He talked to them. They called us and said, do you want to try audition? And we said, yes, we auditioned.
Did anybody say no?
No.
People are looking at me like, you crazy? You didn't win, but you were fan favorites. You came in fourth, and that is a big field of contestants. Mm-hmm. So is it a happy feeling, kind of a frustrating?
For Afro Blue at the time, Traces of Blue now, we basically didn't really think we'd make it as far as we did on the show. I mean, some of us had watched The Sing-Off in the past, and we know it's a pop show. Like, you go on the show and you're singing these popular songs from the radio, and, you know, we were a jazz ensemble from Howard University. You know, we're using our minds, everything's so calculated, and, you know, there's nothing really poppy about what we come from. And so we were really excited to have made it onto the show at all, and so for us to have made it to fourth place, we were so grateful.
So don't draw anything from the fact that I'm directing this question to you. I'm going to ask you this.
Okay.
Diva is a musical term for a reason, and I was just I was just wondering if it was hard for, I can hear each of your voices individually. Like, I heard you when you were warming up, and I can hear because I'm here with you physically. I can see when each of you is contributing, and I just wondered, was it hard for any of you to agree to be part of an ensemble, because each of you is really an artist in your own right?
We definitely all are artists in our own right, but we love each other so much and have performed together in other ensembles for years and had been performing for years together before the sing-off. And so it definitely wasn't a difficult thing to slide into and to get used to, if you will. Granted, the sing-off, that competition was definitely very different. There were definitely many challenges that came along with it, you know, having to really, really learn each other's personalities under different circumstances, sometimes very difficult ones. But
I'm looking for body language here just to see what I can see, but I'm not picking up anything so far.
But we love each other, and we love singing together, and so that definitely wasn't something that was difficult at all.
So speaking of singing together, let's hear another, shall we?
All right. One, two.
As the sun I feel good, but nothing's enough. And as the moon begins to show, I gotta love.
How do you go about picking material?
Well, we all talk about it all the time. You know, it could end up becoming a series of emails that we're annoyed by. But we look at, you know, the charts, we think about what we like, and we just go for it, really. That last tune, Christy actually wrote.
Oh, you know,
she did the arrangement herself, and we just tried to sing what she put on paper.
Oh, Christy, so what was your inspiration?
I think what inspired me at the time, I was in grad school, and I was probably having a bad day, and I just needed to tell myself that I feel good and I feel great, and to, you know, be loving to everyone that I meet, because
there are passages of scripture there that I think people recognize from Corinthians.
Yes, ma'am. So. Yes, ma'am. So mm-hmm. that was my inspiration, just, you know, loving and being kind to everyone.
I look all around me to find, searching for something to satisfy. But outside my window, I see nothing but violence and war. But as we go, help everyone to know to spread peace and joy. It can make a difference in our world. Give us strength to hope, fill our hearts with love. And the greatest of these is love. And the greatest of these is love. And the greatest of these is love.
You're all young, I have to say it. I'm sorry. You probably don't feel very young at this point, but you are. But jazz is not associated with your age group. I just have to be honest about it. And I just wonder... do you ever feel like they don't really understand it? Do people appreciate it? What about John?
It is always a challenge to find out how to make the genre itself accessible to this generation. But like you said, all of us really are still a part of this generation, which means that we don't listen to just jazz. We're influenced by just about every other kind of music that you can think of. And a lot of the elements that are in those music that makes those genres so accessible, so attractive to people, they often find their way into what we do anyway. Mm-hmm. So that's probably what I love most about this group. We're able to offer jazz to you on a plate with a whole lot of sides that you really like. So you're like, okay, well, I'll try this main course because I know I'm going to love the mashed potatoes, you know, that kind of thing. So it's worked out. Yeah, that was pretty good, John. It's worked out pretty well.
Well, thank you all so much for coming. I'm excited to see what you do next. I think you're going to grace us with one more song as we say goodbye for now. What are we going to hear?
Change.
Change is going to come. A change is going to come.
Yeah, we can do that.
Okay. All right. That goes to the roots. Okay. Traces of Blue joined us here in our Washington, D.C. studios. Thank you all so much.
Thank you for having us.
A change is going to come. Here it is.
I was born by the river. Ding, 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 ding. In little tents. Ooh, but just like that river, I've been running ever since.